This episode is brought to you by GoSim. Visit gosim.com/bestoftheleft to start saving up to 85% on calls when you travel abroad. Now, welcome to the award-winning Best of the Left podcast with clips today from The Daily Show, Ring of Fire, Bill Moyers Journal, and The Young Turks.
Christmas Eve vote to pass health care, the Senate returns to the Hill to reconcile their version of the health care bill with the bill previously passed by our House of Representatives. And you know what that means, open government fans? This is the moment we've been promised.
When we are negotiating for that plan, we are going to have C-SPAN on, and you will see who's compromising the American people's interests.
This will all be televised on C-SPAN. Broadcasting those negotiations on C-SPAN.
I'm going to do it on C-SPAN.
On C-SPAN.
On C-SPAN.
Oh, yeah. We're going to do it on mother C-SPAN. I got my 3D glasses. I got my snacks. By the way, I always buy my popcorn at the movie theater and then sneak it home because it tastes so much better when it's ridiculously expensive. All right, let's turn on the C-SPAN and watch some healthcare negotiations. All right, it's not on C-SPAN 1 there, or let's try again there. Let's see. Okay, it's not on C-SPAN 2. Maybe it's on C-SPAN Classic. Let me see if that's, is it on? No, it's not on C-SPAN Classic.
1938 vote on the Fair Labor Standards Act.
You know what? I have an idea. Let's try C-SPAN Español. Let's see if it's on.
Bienvenido a Notas de Libro.
How about C-SPAN English, but with a Spanish accent?
Welcome to the book notes.
Well, I've checked all the C-SPANs, even the ones that I made up. What gives?
C-SPAN is not allowed in to these negotiations as they are going on Capitol Hill between the House and Senate trying to merge the two health care reform bills. In fact, the C-SPAN founder, Brian Lamb, is asking the president and party leaders to open up and to make good on the promises you just heard from candidate Obama.
Oh, shh! Once again, we scoop the news. Booyah! In your face! Once again, the little show on the Comedy Network got the story first and showed candidate Obama hypocritically not doing what President Obama is doing. Sad commentary on the state of the MSN.
The video doesn't lie. President Obama making a promise over and over again.
Not once, but at least five times. And feel free to count along with me.
During the campaign, though, candidate Obama
will have the negotiations televised on C-SPAN.
Repeatedly promised.
It's just not as fun this way when you do your job. I'll tell you, you know who's going to really make a meal out of this? Fox and Friends. After a couple of years of relentlessly manufacturing Obama scandal, from Obama's alleged push to socialist tyranny to what it really means that he got a Portuguese water dog, I mean, now they got him actually busted on tape.
Maybe he didn't know that deals are brokered behind closed doors.
He's a former U.S. senator. He knows what goes on.
And I'm not saying that's right or wrong either. I'm not saying it's right, but maybe he didn't understand that.
Is it a commitment?
That's it? Kind of mild. Reminds me of that time my dog actually caught a squirrel. After all those years of trying, kind of threw him. After a while, he just let it go. He looked sad, like he'd ruined something for himself.
We'll be right back.
Ian, let me ask you, the third idea that you have, we talked about the lie that government is the problem, the lie that universal health care is just too costly. Let's talk about the third lie, that is that if we allow the free market system to do its thing, everything's going to be okay. That is the Milton Friedman biggest lie, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and they're all interconnected. I mean, they're all part of the same thing. But the last thing that says that, here's basically what underlies the lie. It says government cannot be efficient, government cannot be innovative, and it's only the private system that will deliver high-quality medical care at a low cost. And it turns out it's a complete lie. Again, we're back to the other lies to say about the private health insurance companies. It just hasn't materialized. Let me put it another way. Let me get to those three assumptions, because there's something very important that comes. I mean, one of the primary things I do is I study crisis management. I study all kinds of crises. And one of the things that happens in every crisis I've studied is, I mean, we can take Oklahoma City. Let me just do it quickly. In Oklahoma City, there were three primary assumptions prior to the crisis that occurred. One, terrorism doesn't happen in the heartland of America. Second, an American won't kill other Americans, won't be a terrorist. And third is that innocent men, women, children won't be killed. Well, here's what a crisis does. It doesn't destroy one assumption or one lie. It destroys all of them. And the reason why we have this healthcare crisis, as you think about it, is that every one of these assumptions or every one of these lies that we've talked about have all crashed. You know, to a certain extent, for some time, they're all true, or at least you function as though they're true. You have a system constructed around them that maybe functions. At least, see, the point is, the current system, technical system, functions very well.
Okay, well, let's get back to the point. The point being, the lie that deregulation is going to solve it, that regulation should not be there, that we should just allow the industry to run in a free market mode. The invisible hand of the market's going to take care of itself. In healthcare, nothing is farther from the truth, is it?
No, nothing is. I mean, that's where those three lies, they reinforce one another. If you had one of them off by itself and you didn't have the other two, you could probably run the system. It might function. But when you have all three of them together, it's deadly. That's the whole point that we're driving for. And also that it's become clear that all three are not only false, but they're lies, as we've been talking.
Well, let's use the drug industry, for example, on this free market. Okay, we try to justify these enormous profits that the industry claims that they have to make because they have to conduct research.
Right.
If you have a new drug, it's very expensive because they have all this innovation, these costs
right,
that they have to spend.
Right.
That is the best. That's the best example of the lie.
Well,
because
it's bogus.
First of all,
it's completely bogus, and the reason is, you know, most of the drug innovations are sponsored by NIH, National Institute of Health, and once they're developed by universities, once they show some promise, the private companies step in and buy them at some cheap, you know, lower price or whatever it is. The major cost of the drug companies is in marketing. It's not in R&D. It's in marketing. So, again, you know, it completely blows out of the water that, you know, the so-called free, you know, private enterprise system is the best system. No, I'm not against private enterprise, as long as it's done well, not, you know, with mountains of greed and all the stuff we've seen in the financial crisis. But again, we keep coming back, which I think is the central point, our central point, is you have to expose these assumptions or lies. You have to keep hitting and hitting and hitting them that they're lying. I mean, we can still see it right now in the ongoing debate. You know, whether it's you have a public option or whether you allow Medicare to do it, you still see all of these myths.
Okay, let's not get too far away from what we're talking about. We're talking about the third lie, and that is that deregulation is going to make things better. And back to the drug issue, the drug industry says, well, you can't regulate our profits because if you do, we can't do R&D. They try to make the argument that, look, we're using all this money to promote our products. truthfully, though, the numbers show that you have people, they're spending $10 billion to sell their products, or $28, $30 billion in 2004 to sell their products. At the same time, they're only spending $30 billion on research and development. So that to me is the best example of the lie. And in order to get there, though, I think your book, Dirty Rotten Strategies, does pick apart all of these lies, and I think you have to do that to understand what you're really dealing with. Unfortunately, Congress doesn't get it.
But in the meantime, I got it hard. Second floor living without a yard. It may be years until the day my dreams will match up with my pay.
Something's not right here. 1 year after the great collapse of our financial system, Wall Street is back on top while our politicians dither. As for health care reform, you're about to be forced to buy insurance from companies whose stock is soaring, and that's just dandy with the White House. Truth is, our capital's being looted. Republicans are acting like the town rowdies, the sheriff is firing blanks, and powerful Democrats in Congress are in cahoots with the gang that's pulling the heist. This is not capitalism at work. It's capital, raw money, mounds of it, buying politicians and policy as if they were futures on the hog market. Here to talk about all this are two journalists who don't pull their punches. Robert Kuttner is an economist who helped create and now co-edits the progressive magazine, The American Prospect, and the author of the book, Obama's Challenge, among others. Also with me is Matt Taibbi, who covers politics for Rolling Stone magazine, where he's a contributing editor. He's made a name for himself writing in a no-holds-barred, often profane, but always informative and stimulating style that gets under the skin of the powerful. His most recent article is Obama's Big Sellout, about the president's team of economic advisors and their Wall Street connections. It's been burning up the blogosphere. Welcome to both of you. Let's start with some news. Some of the big insurance companies, WellPoint, Cigna, United Health, all surged to a 52-week high in their share prices this week when it was clear there'd be no public option in the health care bill going through Congress right now. What does that tell you, Matt?
Well, I think what most people should take away from this is that the massive subsidies for health insurance companies have been preserved while it's also expanded their customer base because of there's an individual mandate in the bill that's going to provide all of these companies with 25 or 30 million new people who are going to be paying for health insurance. So it's obviously a huge boon to that industry, and I think Wall Street correctly read what the healthcare effort is all about.
Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff, was Bill Clinton's political director, and Rahm Emanuel's takeaway from Bill Clinton's failure to get health insurance passed was don't get on the wrong side of the insurance companies. So their strategy was cut a deal with the insurance companies, the drug industry, going in. And the deal was, we're not going to attack your customer base, we're going to subsidize a new customer base. And that script was pre-cooked, so it's not surprising that this is what comes out the other side.
So are you saying that this, what some call a sweetheart deal between the pharmaceutical industry and the White House, done many months ago before this fight really began, was because they want to keep the drug company money in the Democratic Party?
Well, it's two things. Part of it was we need to do whatever it takes to get a bill. Never mind whether it's a really good bill. Let's get a bill passed so we can claim that we solved health insurance. Secondly, let's get the drug industry and the insurance industry either supporting us or not actively opposing us, so that there was some skirmishing around the details. But the deal going in was that the administration, drug companies, insurance companies are on the same team. Now, that's one way to get legislation. It's not a way to transform the health system. Once the White House made this deal with the insurance companies, The public option was never going to be anything more than a fig leaf, and over the summer and the fall, it got whittled down to almost nothing, and now it's really nothing.
Yeah, and this was Howard Dean's point this week, was that this individual mandate that's going to force people to become customers of private health insurance companies, the Democrats are going to end up owning that policy, and it's going to be extremely unpopular, and it's going to be theirs for a generation. It's going to be an albatross around the neck of this party.
Think about it. The difference between social insurance and an individual mandate is this. Social insurance, everybody pays for it through their taxes. So you don't think of Social Security as a compulsory individual mandate. You think of it as a benefit, as a protection that your government provides. But an individual mandate is an order to you to go out and buy some product from some private profit-making company that, in the case of a lot of moderate-income people, you can't afford to buy. And the shell game here is that the affordable policies are either very high deductibles and copays, so you can afford the monthly premiums, but then when you get sick, you have to pay a small fortune out of pocket before the coverage kicks in. Or if the coverage is decent, the premiums are unaffordable. And so here's the government doing the bidding of the private industry, coercing people to buy profit-making products that maybe they can't afford, and they call it health reform.
So explain this to the visitor from Mars. I mean, just this week, the Washington Post and ABC News had a poll showing that the American public supports the Medicare buy-in by a margin of some 30 points.
Right.
And yet it went down like a lead balloon.
Look, there are two ways, if you're the president of the United States, sizing up a situation like this, that you can try and create reform. One is to say, well, the interest groups are so powerful that the only thing I can do is I can work with them and move the ball a few yards, get some incremental reform, hope it turns into something better. The other way you can do it is try to rally the people against the special interests and play on the fact that the insurance industry, the drug industry, are not going to win any popularity contest with the American people, and you, as the president, be the champion of the people against the special interests. That's the course that Obama chose not to pursue.
And I think, a lot of what the Democrats are doing, they don't make sense if you look at it from an objective point of view. But if you look at it as a business strategy, if you look at the Democratic Party as a business, and their job is basically to raise campaign funds and to stay in power, what they do makes a lot of sense. They have a consistent strategy, which involves negotiating a fine line between sentiment on the left and the interests of the industries that they're out there to protect. And they've always kind of taken that fork in the road and gone right down the middle of the line, and they're doing that with this health care bill, and it's consistent.
If you were a Republican, wouldn't you feel right now that it's going your way? I mean, the Democrats control the White House, they control Congress, and the only thing they've been able to make happen this year is escalate the war in Afghanistan.
The Democrats are in exactly the same position that the Republicans were in once the Iraq war turned bad. All the Republicans have to do now is sit back and watch the Democrats make a disaster out of this health care effort, and they're going to gain political capital, whether they're in the right or not. And I think it's a terrible thing for the party.
Some of your progressive readers and colleagues are going to take issue with you, of course, because there are progressive figures like John Podesta of the Center for American Progress, Kevin Drum, and others who say, look, this bill has its real problems. It's got some real toxic qualities to it, but it's not as bad as Kuttner and Taibbi think. This is a Senate bill, covers 30 million plus more people, has subsidies for low-income families, spreads the risk, lowers some premium costs, creates some exchanges where people can shop for better coverage and prices. You know, don't be too hard on it.
Well, my co-editor, Paul Starr, in the editorial, in the current issue of The Prospect, takes exactly that position, that don't be too hard on Obama. He inherited a really difficult situation, and we're making incremental progress. If we could have done better, we would have. Paul and I disagree about that. I mean, I think one of the challenges of a president is to transform the reality rather than just work within its parameters. I think the other problem, frankly, is that those of us who consider ourselves progressives invested so much in this remarkable figure, Barack Obama, and we read our own hopes into him. We saw him as a potentially great president. We saw this as a potentially transformative moment, I certainly did, where he could have chosen to be the kind of president Roosevelt was. And it turns out that's not who he is characterologically, and that's not how he chose to play the moment.
Can't explain the who or what I was trying
You're probably aware that if you use your cell phone while traveling abroad, you're going to get raked over the coals with roaming charges. Well, I want to give you another option. GoSim is a company that provides international SIM cards you can use in your own phone and load with prepaid minutes that save you about 85% on those international calls. The minutes never expire and can be used in 175 countries. In fact, in 75 countries, including all of Europe, you can receive calls and text messages for absolutely free. I sincerely encourage you to check out the deal at this special URL, gosim.com/bestofleft. Be sure to use this address so they know I sent you. gosim.com/bestofleft. Could have crossed the line, it was black and white, no contrast to
be seen. What would you do? Rush Limbaugh is going to answer a question about what happened to him with his health care scare in Hawaii, well, from a caller. And what he says in response is a little amazing. But understand this context. Rush Limbaugh apparently pays out of pocket for any expenses that he has. And, you know, obviously he had that scare in Hawaii. He went to the emergency room. He held a press conference afterwards saying about, you see this, I got the best care in the world here. Yeah, I know, Rush, because you are a multi-millionaire. Yes, if you make $50 million a year, you get excellent care in this country. But he says, no, anybody can get it. Now, listen to his answer and see if this really applies to you. Let's go to clip number 9.
Let me tackle first in order the things that you've said here. You've said that the treatment I got would bankrupt you, and you guessed that the treatment cost $40,000.
Right, that's correct.
Okay. It did not cost anywhere near $40,000.
Okay.
It cost less. It didn't even cost half what the average SUV owned by the average American family is.
Right.
Jesus.
Now, you say that the average working man couldn't come up with a payment plan, couldn't afford this.
Right.
Because of the American lifestyle. You got to have your mortgage, you got to have a car, you got to have this and that. Then you say that this is why liberals are for health care, because they're compassionate. What you're saying is you want me and other citizens to pay for your health care that you don't want to have to pay for. Who do you think is going to pay for it if you don't?
But you're paying for it anyway by the people who are not insured anyway. The premiums that you're paying, or
I don't pay premiums. I purposely opt out of the health insurance system because of my own proclivities. I just don't want to be involved in a bureaucracy. I have no desire to have a government bureaucrat in the state or an insurance company bureaucrat deciding, getting in the way between me and my doctor. Now, I'm very lucky in this, but it's something I've worked for.
Yeah, but there's only...
And that we could get to... No, it used to be that way for everybody in this country,
but
friend.
It used to be
until liberals got involved in this. When I was a kid, went to the doctor, they sent a bill. Hospital sent a bill. Medicare, Medicaid come into play, all this, the government creating HMOs, thank you, Ted Kennedy, prices start to skyrocket. There's no reason this had to happen, and there's no reason we can't go back to the way it was.
Oh, there were a couple of gems in there. It was just a half of the price of an average SUV. Oh, that's all? I mean, what are we talking about, average SUV? $30,000, $40,000? Okay, what is that? Half of the price makes it $50,000 to $20,000. Who has $15,000 to $20,000 to give to a hospital if you felt a little chest pain and you went in? But this guy, he's living in la la land. He has no idea. $15,000 to $20,000? Who's got that lying around? Hey, Sus, you got $15,000 to $20,000 lying around? JR, you got $15,000 to $20,000 lying around?
I'm not telling you about it.
Okay, all right, yeah, okay. 15 to 20. What? It's just half the price of your average SUV. What's the big deal? Man, you think he's one of you? You think he's for the common guy? He has no idea what the common guy's dealing with. That's why he says half the things he says on his show. He just, if you notice in the second half of that, he was like, who's going to pay for it? Me? I don't want to pay for you. I only make $50 million a year. I'm not paying for you. No, Rush, you missed the whole point of insurance. We all pay into a fund. Okay, and if we need it, then we get out of that fund. That's how insurance works. And as the caller pointed out, we're all paying in anyway, and those guys who don't have insurance are getting out
the all that money from their emergency room care, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if we all get insurance, that's the mandate. That's the upside of the mandate, right? Then we all pay into it and then take it out when we need it. That's how insurance works. Now, Rush doesn't use insurance. Why? Because of his proclivities. Oh, yeah, you don't care, but you don't want the bureaucrats. Duke, I see you, man. We all see you. He doesn't want any records of all the crazy stuff he's doing. You think he wants the, you know, the bureaucrats? He doesn't want anybody knowing all the pills he's taking. It's so obvious. It's so obvious. Look, put aside speculation about why he got, sick or had a pill panic or whatever it is, right, over in Hawaii, because it wasn't his heart. And they say it's not his heart now, right? But we know in the past he was a drug addict. He says it. He says, yeah, I confess. I took hundreds of pills a day. You think he wanted that in his medical records? No. That's why he pays. And he's a multimillionaire, so he can do it. So he pays out of his pocket and goes, $15,000, $20,000. Who cares? What difference does it make? And then he's like, I remember the old days when Doc would come in and he'd give us an apple, and I was fine before the Democrats came in. You listen, you moron. Okay, back in the day, people died because we didn't know how to treat cancer. So the doctor would come in with an apple and a saw, right? And then, you got a problem with your leg. Then they saw it off, okay? And, yeah, you could pay for them because the saw doesn't cost that much, right? Now we do chemotherapy, we do cancer, et cetera. We don't have $15,000, $150,000, $1.5 million lying around to pay for that, okay? Now, it's a good thing. We save a lot more lives with that treatment. That's why we pay into insurance, and then if we need it, we get it out. But Rush doesn't want any part of that because he's got his own money and all he cares about is protecting his own money. You're coming after my money. I don't want to pay for it. And I don't want you knowing what I'm doing. Him pretending he's for the common man is the biggest joke there is. And if that didn't show it to you, nothing will. Then you're blinded by it. Every time I
Yes or no? If you were a senator, would you vote for this Senate health care bill?
No.
Bob?
Yes.
Why? You just said it's designed to enhance the fortunes of the industry.
Well, it's so far from what I think is necessary that I don't think it's a good bill. But I think if it goes down, just because of the optics of the situation and the way the Republicans have framed this as a make-or-break moment for President Obama, it will make it easier for the Republicans to take control of Congress in 2010. It will make Obama even more gun-shy about promoting reform. It will create even more political paralysis. It will embolden the Republicans to block what this president is trying to do, some of which is good at every turn. So I would hold my nose and vote for it.
My feeling on it is just looking more concretely at the health care problem. This is a bill that to me doesn't address the two biggest problems of the health care crisis. One is the inefficiency and the bureaucracy and the paperwork, which it doesn't address at all. It doesn't standardize anything. The other is price, which is now falling by the wayside because there's going to be no public option that's going to drive down prices. So if a health care bill that doesn't address those two problems to me is, and additionally, is a big giveaway to the insurance companies because it provides, it creates this new customer base. It's something I personally couldn't vote for.
Aren't you saying that in order to save the Democratic president and the Democratic Party in 2010 and 2012, you have to have a really rotten health insurance bill?
Well, when you come down to one pivotal moment where a bill is before Congress and the administration has staked the entire presidency on this bill, and you're a progressive Democrat, Are you going to vote for it or not? Let me put it this way. If I were literally like in the position that Joe Lieberman is in, and it was up to me to determine whether this bill live or die, I would hold my nose and vote for it, even though I have been a fierce critic of the path this administration's taken.
But doesn't that further the dysfunction and corruption of the system that you write so often about? I mean, you said a few weeks ago that our failed health care system won't get fixed because it exists entirely within the confines of yet another failed system, the political entity known as the United States of America. You said we have a government that is not equipped to fix actual crisis. So if Bob votes for a bill that in his heart and in his mind he does not believe really helps the situation, isn't he furthering a government that can't solve the actual crisis?
I think so. I understand his point of view, but my feeling is if you vote for this bill and it passes, that's your one shot at fixing a catastrophic and completely, you know, dysfunctional healthcare system for the next generation, maybe. And I think it's much better for the Democrats to lose on this issue and then have to regroup maybe 8 years later, 6 years later, and try again and do a better job the next time than to have it go through.
We're going to have to do that anyway. In other words, these fights never end. We're going to have to go back and make a fight another day. And hopefully that won't be 20 years from now. Hopefully it will be 6 years from now. I think if this bill goes down, it's going to be even harder to get the kind of legislation we want because the Republicans are really going to be on the march. So the Democrats are really between a rock and a hard place here. Because if it loses, there's one set of ways the Republicans gain. If it wins, there could be another set of ways the Republicans gain. And this is all because of the deal that our friend Rahm Emanuel struck back in the spring of passing a bill that's a pro-industry bill that doesn't really get at the structural problems.
But that's the whole point. If the Democrats had used as a political strategy, we're just going to do what the vast majority of our constituents want and pass a bill that was real, that had real teeth to it, that provided real benefits and actually fixed the problems, then, you know, the political benefits that the Republicans could have had after the passage of the bill would have been very limited, it seems to me. They could have only gone that one direction and criticized it, you know, as a socialist giveaway. They couldn't have criticized it as an industry giveaway and ineffective.
Look, this is not Monday morning quarterbacking. I mean, right. I was making the same criticisms that you were at the time. But now we're down to a moment of final passage. And maybe my views are very ambivalent, but I would still vote for it because I think the defeat would be absolutely crushing in terms of the way the press played it, in terms of the way it would give encouragement to the far right in this country that we can block this guy if we just fight hard enough, if we just demagogue it.
But couldn't that defeat turn into that crushing defeat? Couldn't that be good for the Democrats? Couldn't it teach them a lesson that, you know, maybe they have to pursue a different course in the future?
Well, you're younger than I am.
Matt, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, a very progressive member of Congress who's been at this table, wanted a public option. He says this health care bill appears to be the legislation that the president wanted in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. It's quite obvious that at the outset of this process, the White House didn't want, for instance, single payer even on the table. When Max mm-hmm. Baucus had his initial discussions in committee on this bill, he invited something like 43 people to give their ideas about, you know, how the bill might look in the future, and he didn't invite a single person from who was an advocate of single payer health care. So that was never on the table, and it's quite clear that the public option was looked at more as a political obstacle for the White House as opposed to something that they really wanted. They kind of used it as something to scare the Republicans and the moderates with, and that's really all it ended up turning out to be.
If he had wanted a public option, if he'd wanted a Medicare buy-in, he could have tried to persuade the public and the Congress.
That's right? What's so galling. Yeah.
Galling.
I mean, if you roll back the tape, he could have played it so differently, and he could have gotten a better bill, but we are where we are.
I mean, that's what George Bush did when he wanted to get something unpopular passed or something that was iffy. I mean, he just took, you know, if there are any recalcitrant members, he just took him in the back room and beat him with a rubber hose until they changed their minds. I mean, he could have taken Joe Lieberman back there and said, look, if Connecticut ever wants a dime of highway money again, you're going to have to play ball in this thing. That's what the president does. I mean, the president has an enormous amount of power. The leaders, the majority leaders have an enormous amount of power. And if they want to pass something, they can do it. Especially when there's a tremendous public mandate to get something like this passed. I just the idea that they couldn't do this is a fallacy.
the Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley, also the best-selling author of Omnivore's Dilemma, An In Defense of Food. His new book is called Food Rules, An Eater's Manual. Please welcome to the program, Michael Pollan.
Great to see you. Very, very nice to see you. Thanks for coming. I enjoy any book that is fun-sized. A snack-sized book.
Can read it in an hour.
You can read it in an hour. It is your rules for healthy living. Give me, what would be your top, if you had to give an overriding simple rule for people to follow?
It's going to sound weird, but eat food.
You have me. Continue.
And avoid edible food-like substances.
But how would you know? For instance, you write in there, don't eat cereal that colors your milk.
Yeah.
But what if your milk is already pink? I use a strawberry milk-like substance.
You're going to have a challenge. Unless you get the little blue marshmallows in the Captain Crunch. Or Lucky Charms it is, I think.
Has it been difficult? You know, I liken this fight in some respects to the fight against smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're parallels, definitely.
And there was a real turning point in that when people realized, you know, that the tobacco companies knew that there was addictive substances in there. Is it going to be similar with food companies?
I don't think so. I mean, the parallels break down a little because you need to eat and you don't need to smoke. That's one thing. But, you know, a lot of the same companies are involved, like Philip Morris owns Kraft.
Philip Morris makes food.
Kraft.
Is it smokable food?
And so if they do, let's just say hypothetically, they know how to manipulate us and get us to eat more of their chips or their burgers or whatever it is, and they've figured out how much high fructose corn syrup and how much fat and how much salt, they've shredded those documents a long time ago because the same lawyers are involved.
Do they know how to do that?
I don't know. I mean, food science is very sophisticated, and it is designed, I mean, this sounds conspiratorial. They're manipulating you to eat more of it, but of course, so is your mother when she cooks a really tasty dinner.
So you're saying that my mother should be sued by people.
I'm saying it's a difficult line to draw.
But isn't there something in producing cheap food that will fill bellies of people that don't have a lot of money? Is there some honor in that?
Yeah. I mean, look, we all love cheap food. And the fact that food has gotten so cheap in our lifetime is a boon to certain people who don't have a lot of money. But I think we need to recognize that cheap food has a very high cost in terms of health, in terms of the environment. And that cost is getting paid by other people, by, you know, the public health system. And that's part of the problem, the disconnect between what you pay for a cheap fast food meal and the ultimate price of eating that way. But I think what's about to happen, if we get this health care bill passed, and there's some kind of minimal rules, no more pre-existing conditions, they can't throw you off the plan, they have to take you, suddenly the health insurers will have an interest in your health that they don't have now. Because right now...
That may be the worst sentence I've ever heard said. Suddenly the health insurers will have an interest in your health, well, which right now they don't.
Their business plan now is to keep you out of their plan if you're likely to get chronic disease. And the Western diet creates a lot of chronic disease. So right now the food industry creates patients for the healthcare industry, and they kind of, you know, have a very sympathetic relationship. But that might change. And if that changes, I think you will see this very powerful industry getting on board this movement, this growing national movement.
But how do you change it? How do you legislate deliciousness? How do you say, does the government come out and say, ice cream must now taste like mud? You know, how would you in any way?
Well, there's a whole lot of things they can do. I mean, one is right now we subsidize the least healthy calories in the supermarket. We subsidize high fructose corn syrup with our farm bill. We subsidize hydrogenated soy oil. And, you know, we don't have
so
to do that.
So what would we subsidize? What would be a thing the government
could subsidize? Figure out ways to encourage production of real food, of fruits and vegetables. We could discourage the consumption of soda, either through public education campaigns or taxes. I mean, there's no, you know, that's the simplest thing you can do. I mean, Americans are getting 15%, 20% of their calories from high fructose corn syrup.
But that, stepping into Americans' kitchens, giving them the choice of what they can and cannot eat, that may be the largest infringement the government would ever attempt.
Well, it's very interesting that we resent that so much. Mm-hmm. The government's saying maybe, you know, don't have 240 pounds of sugar a year, which is what we're eating. But we don't resent...
In one weekend.
We don't resent it when your doctor says you're on Lipitor for the rest of your life or stents now. You know, that seems, oh, yeah, sure, we'll do that. We do whatever they tell us to do.
It's perhaps
you can prevent
a problem making connections that we have.
Yeah.
Well, tonight I'm really going to think twice about, I always celebrate every show with a triple, quadruple.
Bypass.
That was awesome.
Food Rules is on the bookshelves now.
Son, look at all the people in this restaurant. What do you think they weigh? Out the window to the parking lot at their SUVs, taking all of the space. They give no fuck, they talk as loud as they want. They give no fuck, just as long as there's enough for them. Gotta get on the microphone down at Walmart, talk about some shit that's been on my mind. Talk about the state of this great nation of ours. People look to your left, yeah, look to your right. They give no fuck, they buy as much as they want. They give no fuck, just as long as there's enough.
What's your take now? Are you more optimistic than you were a week ago about healthcare?
Well, we got it done. I mean, it was an extremely close vote. I don't think people understood how close it really was. We had a Republican who waited until the last 5 minutes of a 15-minute vote and decided that it was better for him to vote with the Democrats than with his colleagues. If not for that, it would have been 219 to 216. And we had two special elections the week before. In both cases, the Democrat won, and the Democrat was sworn in immediately to take part in that vote. If not for that, it would have been 217 to 216. So it was a really close vote, and I'm glad we've put it behind us because America really needs health care reform. We've got 44,789 people in this country who die every year because they have no health care. That's not my word. That's the word of a Harvard study published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. We've got over a million people in this country who go bankrupt every year because they can't pay their health care bills. And we've got well over 40 million people in this country who have no health coverage and simply cannot see a doctor when they need to. And the deaths and the bankruptcies are a direct result of that. And not only that, but we have people who are afraid to lose their jobs and can't change jobs because even if they get a better job, it's a well-paying job, they're not going to have any health coverage for their pre-existing conditions. And we've got situations where the medical insurance companies can literally pull the plug on you when you're sick because you reach a lifetime cap on your coverage. Maybe it's $250,000, maybe it's $500,000. But whatever it is, if they pay out that much on you, it's bye-bye for you. And then you're on your own and you have to pay all your own bills and go bankrupt and see your family lose your house and everything like that. We set up a website called namesofthedead.com. In which we invited people to come and tell their stories of people who they loved, people who they cherished, who lost their lives because they had no health care coverage. And thousands of people have written into us. And we've posted hundreds of stories at the website explaining exactly that. And these are really touching stories. They're so touching that I took them onto the floor of the house and read them, just simply read them, because I felt that they were much more vivid and much more honest and, frankly, much more eloquent than anything I could come up with myself. These are people who Jesse Jackson used to call the dispossessed, the despised, and the damned. People who were utterly abandoned by us. And in some respects, they die for our sins. The sin of neglect.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
I am more proud of this show and love working on it more than anything else I've ever done in my life, and the members who sign up and stick with the show are the ones who allow me to follow my passion. Members sign up to donate as little as $5 a month or even $55 a year to support the show. In return, besides my undying gratitude, they also receive bonus material through the members-only raw feed. This includes audio and video content from the show, and bonus material that would otherwise end up on the cutting room floor. All of this is delivered in organized feeds so members can access what they want and ignore what they don't. If you're a regular listener of this show and appreciate the service it provides, please consider becoming a member by visiting the membership tab at bestoftheleft.com. Thanks a lot.
Chicago Tribune did an excellent story on this, and let me give you some exact numbers as to two different problems. One is the actual amount of money they spent. Over the last 2 years, as we've been debating this and leading up to the debate of this, healthcare clients spent $635 million lobbying. $635 million. Now, you think somebody spends $635 million and doesn't expect a return on investment? Of course they do, right? And give you a small example that the Chicago Tribune talked about. We had medical manufacturers, device manufacturers, who were going to get a tax on them of $40 billion because all these industries are making way too much. Instead of changing that, what the Democrats are doing is slapping on taxes or regulations, some of which you can argue for, some of which you can say is the wrong way to go about it. Anyway, but in the almost the final version, that tax for the device manufacturers was $40 billion. They sent in their team of lobbyists, almost all former congressional aides and congressmen, and all of a sudden, magically, that got knocked down to $20 billion. Now think about that. They just saved $20 billion for just that small, tiny portion of the healthcare industry. So you think it makes sense for the entire industry to spend $635 million in 2 years? Of course it does. And they got their money back in spades. And now the second part of that is not just the money they spend, but who they give the money to. It's not just the current politicians for their reelection campaigns. They hire former staff and former congressmen and senators. So the healthcare industry hired 166 former aides to 9 congressional leadership offices and 5 committees involved in healthcare debate, okay? And 13 former lawmakers. So that's 179 overall. But if you take all the companies, whether they're healthcare companies or not, lobbying on the healthcare bill, because there are non-healthcare companies that also lobby about this particular bill, it comes out to 278 former either congressional staff or actual congressmen and senators. 278 of them. Now, why do they do that? And that's really important. Because, one, they get obvious and easy access to the current congressmen and senators. I mean, this guy was his chief of staff. What are you going to do? What do you think? He's not going to take his call? Of course. And is he going to feel bad about saying no to him? Yeah, of course he'll feel bad about it. So they get some sort of institutional advantage there. Number two, a legitimate reason they hire them is because it gives them a lay of the land. How do you fight legislation? How do you fight for legislation, et cetera? But point number three is the one that is really a big problem for the way our system is set up. All the people who work in Congress now know that there's a big payday if they play ball now. The payday comes later when they get hired as lobbyists. So if you've been a good boy and you've given in to those lobbyists over and over again, when you get out, you're going to get paid a hell of a lot more from those same guys. If you didn't play ball and you went against the interests of those lobbies, well, you think they're going to hire you when you come out? No, they're not going to hire you. And so that being the case, these hiring all these guys to do your bidding for you gives you an enormous advantage. We've got to fix that system. Until we do, these lobbyists are going to continue to win, not just on healthcare, but every issue.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy, but mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes.
Well, let's begin tonight in Massachusetts, where tomorrow voters will go to the polls in a special election to fill the Senate seat that Ted Kennedy held for 46
years, a seat that he won in a special election to replace his brother John, who had won it himself in a super secret special election to replace his brother George Kennedy, who had left to go film The Dirty Dozen. I loves me some Wikipedia. Now, whether or not Ted Kennedy will be replaced by his younger brother, Jamie, is obviously... No? Don't look it up. It's obviously up in the air. But one thing is for sure. Take this to the bank. The Senate seat in Massachusetts will be won by a Democrat. That's how it is. That's how it was. That's how it will always be. Our ancestors fought and died so that the Massachusetts Senate seat would be a safe one for either a Kennedy or a Democrat. So, we'll just move on to our next story. And I'm sorry, you have something to run?
Is that... We're going to start this hour with this showdown in Massachusetts that a lot of people didn't expect. The latest polls out today show that Brown, the Republican, has anywhere from a 5 to 10 point lead.
I said what? I am what?
What the? 15 months ago, Barack Obama carried Massachusetts by 26 points. Who is this wondrous creature, this Republican who has so captivated the hearts of this bluest of states?
My name is Scott Brown, and I'm running for the United States Senate. This is my truck.
Gone.
Scott Brown, as we mentioned, is a state senator here in Massachusetts.
Brown's wife, Gail Huff, a veteran Boston TV reporter.
He is also a member of the Massachusetts National Guard.
One of their daughters did very well on American Idol a couple of years ago. Yeah. And this 1982 nude photo layout resurfaced. Brown had won a Sexiest Man contest in Cosmopolitan magazine.
So the Democrats are losing to Captain Freeball.
The Kennedy legacy goes down to a naked guy who owns a truck. Did you hear his bio? For God's sakes, the guy sounds like a fictional character in some racy David E. Kelly show about politics.
Tonight on an all-new Mass Appeal. Senator McDangley exercises his pocket veto.
By the way, I don't know why we had Margaret Cho in a wheelchair in that picture. How does the Democratic candidate, a one Martha Coakley, state attorney general, lose to this cat?
Martha Coakley may have made a big political gaffe here in Boston when she referred to Curt Schilling, the former Boston Red Sox pitcher,
as a
Yankees fan.
All right, that doesn't sound like much, but let's put it in some perspective here for non-sports fans. That'd be like saying that John Lennon's favorite Beatle was Mickey Dolenz. All right. Well, it's not anything a little retail politics can't overcome. This is Massachusetts, baby. Get out there, shake a few hands, do some mating and grating. She said what now? Ah, apparently when the Boston Globe asked her if she was being too passive in campaigning, she replied, as opposed to standing outside Fenway Park in the cold, shaking hands. Let me see if I can field this one for you. Yes! What are you doing on the campaign trail? Boy, what are you handing me this baby for? A kiss? You're his mom. You kiss him. Maybe Coakley's just playing hard to get.
Democratic officials say that she has not turned out to be the best campaigner.
The Massachusetts Senate candidate caught on camera not offering a hand to help a guy who was knocked over by a supporter of hers.
Coakley insulted Fenway Park.
She is not a fan of shaking hands either.
The Coakley campaign actually misspelled Massachusetts.
Coakley was asked her favorite cream pie. She said banana. Coakley believes Larry Bird is a Sesame Street character. Coakley went into the bar in Cheers and didn't know anybody's name.
Hey, Jerome. No, that's not right. All right, one senator out of 100, special election, come see, come saw. Better luck next time, Democrats.
President Obama made a beeline for Massachusetts this afternoon. He's campaigning for Democrat Martha Coakley in a special election.
No! What are you doing?
What happens in Massachusetts is going to be critically important for this president's agenda.
If Democrats lose the seat, it would end their supermajority in the Senate.
The Scott Brown victory here would essentially dash the hopes for passage of health care reform.
If health care dies, I think that we're going to see a new president in 2012.
So Obama must ensure that Coakley wins if he's to win in 2012. Doc Brown, fire up the DeLorean. We're going to the future. Democrats, meet me at camera three. Let me see if I have this straight. You need to replace perhaps the most beloved liberal in the history of the Senate with a candidate that believes Curt Schilling is a Yankee fan. Because if this lady loses, the health care reform bill that the beloved late senator considered his legacy will die. And the reason it will die let's continue. The reason it will die is because if Coakley loses, Democrats will only then have an 18-vote majority in the Senate, which is more than George W. Bush ever had in the Senate when he did whatever the f*** he wanted to do. In fact, the Democrats have a greater majority than Republicans have had since 1923. But for Democrats, apparently a majority of 100 is 60. I need my inhaler. And the state that you need to save health care reform is Massachusetts. Perhaps the one state whose health care system is already more progressive than anything promised in the health care reform bill, therefore making them perhaps one of the only states that suffers not a whit from the dying of this bill. You really f*** yourself, Jack. That y'all are in this special election position in the first place is because 6 years ago, Massachusetts Democrats changed the rule that empty Senate seats would be appointed by governors. Because at that time, they were sure that a senator named John Kerry was about to win the White House. And they didn't want a Mitt Romney appointing a Republican senator to Kerry's position, which would have derailed the Democrats' ability to concede to the Republicans' every whim. Strategy. See, it's not that the Democrats are playing checkers and the Republicans are playing chess. It's that the Republicans are playing chess and the Democrats are in the nurse's office because once again they glued their balls to their thighs. I'm sorry, I thought I was in good enough shape to get through a simple explanation of how f***ed up the Democrats are, but they're really f***ed up, so. It's not your fault, Democratic Party leadership. No one should have raised the bar of expectations for you. We should just leave the bar on the ground. Wait for you to trip.
Thanks for listening, everybody. First of all, in case you've been living under a rock, yes, the Democrats lost the seat in Massachusetts. Ted Kennedy's old seat now belongs to, as near as I can tell, a teabagger. Second of all, a couple of interesting things happened in response to the previous episode, which was a repost from just after the 2008 election. You know, it was a great inspirational piece at the time of Obama speeches with music covering, you know, the entire election all the way from 2004 when he first came on the scene up through the 2008 election and speeches and the reaction to it. And it was, you know, great and inspirational at the time. And of course, now a year later, people's reactions are a little bit different. The personal reactions I've been getting have been almost uniformly negative and depressing in that, boy, I listened to that and it just made me sick for how things are going now. Or, you know, it made me angry that he was so inspirational then and has not followed through to such an extent now. Anyways, so that was mostly the reaction to it. But I have an interesting story that goes along with it that I'll get to in just a moment. I want to get this out of the way and thank a couple of members first. Gina L. signed up for a membership on December 1st and went above and beyond the minimum membership donation amount. So thanks very much, Gina, for supporting the show. And Eleanor H. signed up on January 9th and went ahead and signed up for a full year of membership. And Eleanor has been a great, you know, listener and longtime supporter of the show. So thanks, Eleanor, for sticking with the show for as long as you have and now sign up for membership to help support it. Okay, so as I said, the reactions were almost entirely negative. There were a couple of people who said, I found it really inspirational, thanks for posting it. But they were definitely in the minority. One fun thing that happened, though, was actually, you know, you know you're making an impact when your own material starts getting sent back to you without the people knowing that you were the one who posted it. So what happened was my boss actually, you know, it didn't get sent to me in particular, but my boss actually received an email saying, you know, from like a coalition partner who sent it out to a big group of people saying, you know, things are a little tough. The Massachusetts vote didn't go very well. The Supreme Court's just punched us in the gut. Check out this show if you need a little pick-me-up. And sent a link to my show. And so he called me down the hall and was like, hey, check this out. Look at the link they just sent to me, you know, as if he didn't know about it. So that was fun. But the other story that goes along with this is the more interesting one. And it started out with a post that someone wrote on the blog. And they said, I think they should lock Obama and his staff and cabinet in the Oval Office and make them all listen to this particular podcast. They believed in these words at one point in time. If they listen again, maybe there will be hope for all of us, or for us all yet. So, you know, I like that. The idea of Obama being forced to listen to my podcast seemed like a good plan. So I posted just kind of joking, hey, does anyone around here have insider access to the White House and you can pass this along? So I posted that in the morning. And just a few hours later, I was at a print shop for work. I was getting a picture printed of a bill signing ceremony with the governor of Maryland. It was a governor, you know, Maryland law had passed. The governor was signing it. And, you know, a bunch of people gather around. You take a picture, bill signing ceremony. So I was getting this picture printed. And so the photograph was actually sitting on the counter at the print shop. And this couple walks in, and so the husband, I suppose, comments on the picture, and he just kind of asks, you know, what it is and what's it all about, and so I explain, and he says, you want to see my picture? And he opens an envelope that he has in his hand, and he pulls out a picture of himself with Barack Obama, and there's a couple other people in the picture, but, you know, that's the point he's making. And I say, thinking back to this comment that's on the blog, I say, oh, that's you. He said, yep. And I said, so you have insider access to the White House a little bit. And he said, yep. So of course I'm thinking, all right, he's probably a big donor or something like that to the Obama campaign. He explains that he went to the Christmas party at the White House, and that's where that picture was taken. So I say, oh, well, that's really interesting. And I instantly pull out my business card. I actually have some Best of the Left podcast business cards that I made a while back. So I hand him a card and I say, you know, actually, I'm a producer and this is a show I do. And I explain, I say, it's interesting that I happen upon you because just a couple of hours ago, I read this post and I explained to him about the previous episode. and how it's a really great and inspirational show, but a year later, my audience is overwhelmingly disappointed in it, and the show is depressing, and so forth. And his reaction is, really? As in, you guys, really, you think that Obama isn't doing that good of a job? He's not being progressive enough? Really? Huh, I just... You know, it was so foreign to him, the idea that anyone would think this administration so far wasn't living up to our expectations. And so that kind of, that set me back a little bit. I thought, oh, well, no, I didn't, you know, it's not that so much, you know, because I don't want to be completely off-putting. I'd like him to at least check out the show. And so, you know, part of what he said is, it sounds really negative. It sounds like the show is really negative. And I thought about it, and in my own head, I thought, well, to some extent, yeah, it is kind of negative, because that's what we do. As I mentioned in the last show, disappointment is an occupational hazard of being a liberal or a progressive, because we're always disappointed with the way things are going, because they could always be better. So we're always going to strive to make things better. So this show naturally focuses on all the things that are going wrong and how we should change them. And so I kind of thought, well... Yeah, it is kind of negative in that sense. You know, we're not just a cheerleader. And so I try to really delicately tell him about the show without making it sound like it's a, you know, nothing's ever good enough and Obama sucks and sold us out kind of show, because I don't really think that that's what this show is. But anyways, that's essentially the story. I told him about how someone had mentioned, you know, Obama should be forced to listen to this show. And I said, yo, you know, if you want to pass this along to him, that'd be great. Of course, I'm mostly joking. I'm not really asking you to do that. But, you know, check out the show. See if you like it. So maybe he's listening, he and his lovely wife, who I met. If you are listening, welcome. I think in all likelihood, I got off on a little on the wrong foot talking about the negative things first. You know, to give a more accurate background, I would say that not only did I support Obama in the primaries and then obviously in the general, but I went out and volunteered at his inauguration and have been, you know, wildly supportive of the ideals set forth, and I'm just pushing as hard as I can to have those ideals come true. Believe it or not, I actually have a little bit more to comment on that, but I'm going to save it for the next show because this one's going long already. I just want to say, since that's it for today, as I always say, please consider supporting the show in the easiest way possible and just tell 5 or 50 friends about it. Word of mouth is making a huge, huge difference in, you know, just spreading the word and getting the show out to as many people as we can. Of course, if you want to do more to support the show, becoming a member is extremely easy and as cheap as a little bit less than $5 a month. And beyond that, there's all sorts of things you can do. Just check out the Support the Show box on the right-hand side of the website. There are lots of completely free ways to help support the show there. If you're not already subscribed to the show, there's a huge number of ways to do that. I promise there is a method there that fits you, even if it's just getting an email every time a new show is posted. Details on that are in the subscribe box, again, on the right side of the website. You can stay connected to the show between episodes by following us or joining us on Twitter or Facebook. And finally, if you're interested in getting the details on the sources or the music used in this or any episode, links to all of that are always going to be in the show notes on the blog. So coming to you from inside the Beltway and border, yet outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, delivered to you every Wednesday and every weekend, thanks only to the members and donors from bestoftheleft.com.
Thought by itself, black and white, you took apart a picture that wasn't right. Pitch burning on a shining sheet. The only maker that you wanna meet. A dying man in a living room. Whose shadow paces the floor. Who'll take you out in the open door. This is not my life. It's just a fond farewell to a friend. It's not what I'm like. It's just a fond farewell to a friend.
Hi, my name is Mike. Could I have your ears for a real short rant? This message is totally unsolicited. In fact, the only way you could be hearing my message right now is because Jay heard this very same recording and gave me a little space. So, thanks, Jay. Hey, talk about penny pinching in this economy. I've whittled down a normal middle class existence to my current bare bones income, and I do it on early Social Security retirement. That's 25% less than regular Social Security. $5 is a lot of money to me, but I consider it important enough to give those dollars to Jay every month to further his great program, the twice weekly Best of the Left podcast. So if you could possibly squeeze a subscription into your budget, do it. Hey, if I can come up with a fiver every month, I think most people can. And if you can't, keep listening, do those free things that Jay asks you to do, and then subscribe when you can. Thanks.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.